Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I am sitting down with Stephen and Simon, who are incredible paramedics down in South Australia, who have also created a company called Guardian Personal Safety Training. So we're going to talk today about such an important component of the job, which is basically maintaining your own personal safety, utilizing proper skills to de-escalate escalated scenes, and also making sure that we actually can thoroughly go through D for danger, which is the mainstay of and the start of pretty much wherever we go whenever we are entering scenes. So Simon and Stephen, thank you so much for jumping on today. Now, I want to get you guys to introduce yourselves properly because, as we've talked about off air, you guys are pretty awesome paramedics with awesome jobs and it sounds really great. So I really would love for you to both go through that. We'll start with you, Stephen.
Yeah, sure. No, firstly, thanks for having us. We've been looking forward to this. So yeah, thanks for having us today. We'll probably maybe correct you there. Probably awesome job, I would say. Maybe not about awesome paramedics. That's probably But we do. We're really fortunate to have great jobs. And so I guess, yeah, if we start there, Simon and myself are on the same team in South Australia, so the South Australian Ambulance Service. And that team is the Special Operations Team. And our title is Rescue and Retrieval Paramedic. So it's sort of quite a fun role, quite a challenging role, but we get to delve into both sides of rescue and retrieval. I've been there now for... 2008 was selection. So what's that now? Yeah, good 13, 14 years. And I guess Special Operations Team covers it. I guess anything normal paramedics can't get to, whether the access is the issue. So it's the environment that obviously offers the scene sort of dangers and risks. So we obviously train to be able to access patients in those environments. So it doesn't make us special, just makes our training probably a bit more advanced to be able to access those patients. And that's anything from vertical rescue, so abseiling, whether that's industrial or wilderness. The sexy stuff that sort of people see more high profile in the news is the helicopter search and rescue components, whether you're winching into a scene or onto a boat or in the water. And then there's tactical EMS, which we are the medics for the tactical police here. So we go into any hostile scenes for them. So we're there primarily for the police. So we're their medics because I guess if they get called in, there's obviously a higher propensity or higher probability they could be shot or stabbed. So they want someone there for them. And then obviously we are there for the victim and assailant. And other scenes involve hazmat, so hazardous environments or CBR, whether it's, you know, chemical, biological, radiation stuff, whether it's deliberate, so acts of terrorism or industrial or accidental or ignorance, people mixing chemicals at home. So we're BA trained and go into sort of hazardous environments. And then there's urban search and rescue, which is known sort of throughout the country and overseas. So we're on a task force there that's internationally deployable. Anything else I'm missing, Simon? What else do we do?
No, that's pretty thorough, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's us and that's our team. So we've kind of had to be intensive care paramedics to be eligible to apply for special ops. So we all went through selection, which is a bit of a process in itself, which is kind of good fun if you get on, not as fun if you don't get on because you sort of get put through the ringer to get through there. But that's sort of us, our background as paramedics in South Australia. And then probably through that, which is probably a good sort of skill set and a good sort of exposure to lots of different, like you touched on, Alex, is D for danger. There's a lot of danger in those environments, I guess, so we get quite good at assessing the risks, how we can mitigate it, how we can see what's potential risk and what's actual risk, and then making ourselves safe first to be able to make the patient safe and the scene safe and fellow colleagues safe. So we get really good at situation awareness, which is a saying we really throw around in the personal safety sort of sides of things. But it gets used a bit too frequently, but people don't probably, they probably underestimate it. Situation awareness is critical in any part of our job, whether you are day one paramedic or old crusty seasoned paramedics like Simon and myself, is situation awareness is paramount in all what we do. And so I guess our jobs there give us a really great understanding of situation awareness in so many environments, and it kind of put us in good stead to look at, well, hang on, what's the dangers when we have, you know, clients and family members and bystanders being the threat? How do we assess those scenes? And sort of the company was sort of birthed through Simon and myself being approached by ambulance service itself, by South Australian Ambulance Service, to review the what was called OPSafety, then operational safety training, which is basically the training dealing with occupational violence. And Simon sort of got approached, and myself, he approached me, and we sort of got involved in that internally because of probably primarily our background with martial arts. So Simon and myself have quite a big history in martial arts ourselves. Between us, we're adding up the years. I think we're up to about 45 years or so between the two of us, which has probably been a hobby and an enjoyment, both of us. But then we kind of looked into that side of things for SAS, and then we were approached by a member who we were training within SAS, who was actually just transport paramedic. And they just said, oh, do you do this externally? And at the time we were going, no, we just got asked to by SAS to look at the program here and probably redevelop it because it hadn't been touched on for a while, and just put our eyes over saying, what do we think we can do? And Simon got really involved with researching other states and law enforcement and what else was around to try get the best training we could offer South Australian paramedics. But yeah, this lady just said, you know, a friend of hers was a GP locum who did home visits, and yeah, I think this person got assaulted quite badly, and he was apparently quite a big presence about him, a big Nigerian gentleman who was a doctor, and they're a husband and wife partnership who responded to locum calls together, and they got assaulted quite badly, and she just kind of rattled off a few things, and she was quite a junior paramedic, and they thought, oh, this is great, but we don't know any of this. And that kind of got me and Simon thinking of, well, we could actually help a lot of other people that aren't within the service. And hence Guardian Personal Safety Training was birthed, where we developed the company. We sort of sat around Simon's kitchen table and started working out how we could help other people that aren't in the ambulance service, and who the clients could be. And then the list became endless. And then the amount of people that approached us became endless as well. So that's sort of how the company started. But we had probably a lot of contacts and networks and credibility within health. So hence we really got very heavily involved with health and hospitals and ambulance services, and now probably our passion and our hearts are with ambulance service because it's our roots. So that's sort of me in a nutshell. Let Simon introduce himself.
Thanks, Steve. Like Steve said, I've been in the ambulance service since early 2000s. This is my 20th year. I actually come up through the transport officer route, and then went on and studied paramedicine, become paramedic, took the intensive care paramedic course, completed that, and then made the step up to special operations to become a rescue and retrieval paramedic. And like Steve said, it was about 2012 when we started this company, and we really didn't at that time grasp what a need there was for this. So we'd seen assaults in our day-to-day work, of course, but didn't truly recognize the extent of the problem until we started studying what research and evidence there were around occupational violence in paramedicine. And when you look at those studies, it's quite amazing. It's not a South Australian problem or an Australian problem. It's a worldwide problem. In fact, other places have a greater extent of occupational violence against paramedics than we do here in South Australia. We are actually quite lucky. But saying that, when you look at the evidence, there is not many paramedics who have not been assaulted. In fact, if you look at the evidence that the leading bodies on this put forwards, it's about 87% of paramedics admit to being assaulted. Yet when Steve and I and all of our trainers do impromptu ad hoc surveys of the classes that we teach, every single person puts their hand up and says they've at least been verbally assaulted, if not physically assaulted. So I guess it was after learning that evidence and that research that Steve and I really decided, hey, there is a need for this. We can make a difference. Our experience in martial arts, our experience in education, and of course our paramedicine experience makes us somewhat subject matter experts on this topic. We just realized that it is a massive problem and we can make a difference. And that's what we've been doing for the last 10 or so years, to the point that we now have clients in other countries. It is a, like I said, it is a worldwide problem.
Absolutely. And you mentioning that, the fact that, you know, 87% are reported, you know, in these studies. But when realistically you're talking to people, pretty much every single person has experienced it in some form or the other. And, you know, it's such a prevalent issue. Thank you first and foremost for actually putting in the time and effort to do something about this. It's pretty awesome. And you guys offer obviously virtual training and then also the face-to-face training. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to sort of pick your brains now, sort of going into pretty much the deep end of it. So we'll go into all of these aspects around personal safety training and what you teach, and sort of hopefully help start to shed light on these issues and sort of educate our audience, who are mainly students, but then also those who are graduates, so who are new and starting out in the role. And so it can be quite confronting learning as a student that this will be something that you have to deal with, unfortunately, on a daily basis, or potentially quite a bit in your career. So, we'll jump straight into it. What is, as you mentioned, we get thrown around a lot, situational awareness. What is situational awareness, and what does it comprise of?
Yeah, so I might grab that one because we spoke recently about this. It sounds very, you know, telling you to suck eggs. It's self-explanatory, yet it's kind of not. We might do things automatically and have good situational awareness. So it's not a sixth sense as such, but as the title sounds, it's being aware of your situation. But what does that mean? And it's saying it. There's a really good definition actually put out by a tactical company, but it applies across any whether you're out with your family, whether you are on your job as in a career. But it's saying having a cognizance of your surroundings, but also it's about where you are and what is around you. But it's also a really good saying that says, and it says, it's not where you are, but it's also where you should be. And that's meaning obviously specifically with positioning, but it's being aware of the situation you're in and what the potential situation could move and progress to be. And that's reading probably the scene quite well. And whatever scene that is, that's whether the people are there, the mood, the body language, the nonverbal communication, the paraverbal communication, how communication is going, how the interactions are between the people and the environment and you and the environment. And then when you get very specific of either where you stand in a room or where you stand when you talk to someone or where you stand when you talk to someone who's in a different mood, and you've got to work out what sort of moods people are in. And it's reading people, and we talk about escalation, but how do people escalate and what are signs of people escalating and what do you do and how do you position yourself? And it's a very long answer, but it's being aware of your surroundings, but what the potential situation could be. And that's probably the foresight that we want to try teach early. So as everything, and but this probably more so than anything, prevention is always better than cure. We could teach you kung fu and martial arts and that's all fantastic, but that's what we don't want to be doing. That's cure. We'd rather read things early and be aware of your surroundings, aware of people and how the scene is panning out or escalating or not escalating.
And I think just building on what Steve said, situational awareness is not a once-off thing you do for a singular patient. So the idea with situational awareness is you enter a scene, you take in all of the cues that you see from the environment and the people there, you deem that to be safe through your risk assessments, and then you predict what can happen in the future. And for every prediction that you make, if things were to change, you need to do a further risk assessment and then employ further situational awareness. So it's not a once-off fixes everything. It's a continuous procedure that we have to undertake in every tasking that we do. But further to taskings in the ambulance service, it is applicable for every moment of our lives. So everywhere we are, external to a safe situation such as our house, we should be aware or alert of what is going on around us. And just going back to the evidence, there was an interesting paper brought out several years ago now where they interviewed 633 healthcare workers who had been assaulted. And they said to them, if you had your time over, what's something you could have done to perhaps prevent this assault from occurring to you? And there were a number of answers, but the number one response was that I became so task focused on the patient in front of me that I neglected or forgot to see everything else that was happening around me. So those environmental cues are so important. No matter what is wrong with that patient in front of us, we still need to have some of our cognitive bandwidth open to be able to absorb those environmental cues. Because if we don't, we can miss some of the red flag indicators. And those red flag indicators are a telltale sign that violence is in about to occur. If we get good at seeing those in the environment and the people around us, we can predict almost that there's a violent act is about to occur, and we can abstract ourselves or extricate from that situation before we have to use any of those self-defense skills that we teach. And Steve makes a good point that we do teach some self-defense skills in our courses, but it is what people remember. It is what we're probably known for, but it is 10% of what we teach. And really, there's not many occasions you should have to use those techniques. If you read the room well, if you read the people well, if you look for those environmental cues, those red flag indicators, if you get good at de-escalation, verbal de-escalation and non-verbal de-escalation, you should be able to know when it is safe to stay and when you must leave the scene before you ever have to use any of those self-defense techniques that we teach.
Yeah, you guys bring up some fantastic points there, and you know, you guys really indicate what situational awareness is. When it comes to recognizing cues, for example, obviously the student who's never set foot on a placement before is going to their first ever case, for example, they're walking in the door, that student who's going to pick up cues, their cue picking up, if any, might be significantly different to obviously the 15-year veteran paramedic who's walked in there 8 times a day every single day they walk on shift. How can people start to sort of develop that sort of cue finding and really think about this properly without a significant amount of experience?
It's a really good point you raise, Alex. And looking at the perpetrators who are committing this violence, they have a lot of factors in them we can recognise and somewhat predict that they may be violent, such as a history of abuse, drug and alcohol, substance abuse. There's a lot of telltale signs that they may escalate. But one of the things that we can also predict on our side of the fence is that newer staff are more likely to be assaulted. And that is due to that inexperience, that not being as effective at picking up those cues. And I guess also because for a new person on the road to take a manual blood pressure, for instance, will take up all their bandwidth and they're going to lose those environmental cues. Yet for Steve, who's been doing this for 20 plus years, it takes up none of his bandwidth. He can still be watching everything that's going on around him. So the reason we pair up in most services, a new paramedic with an experienced paramedic is so that new person can rely on the years of experience and almost street smarts that seasoned paramedic brings. So that's why we do that. And I think that's really effective and important that as a new paramedic, if your senior paramedic lets you know that there is some danger, and even if you don't feel it, don't recognize it, you must trust what they're telling you until you develop those experiences and that gut feel yourself. Now, there's other solutions to this problem that the researchers put out, and the number one that they talk about is actually courses such as what we teach. So learning effective communication, learning de-escalation skills, learning good scene safety skills and situational awareness and those self-defense techniques. So that is also very important. So most places, most ambulance services these days around the world are putting a great deal of emphasis on this training because we know it works, we know it keeps our staff safer, and we know it decreases the incidence of violence and aggression that these organisations are receiving. So those courses are probably the number one thing they can do.
Yeah, and just if I can follow on from there, I think it's also, there's a really good point that's brought up there is experience, and there's some things that will only come with experience, and that's not to put fear into people that are, you know, new on the job and sort of student paramedics. However, in saying that, you know, there's that saying, practice makes perfect. The reality is perfect practice makes perfect, or at least doing appropriate, proper, correct practice makes perfect. So you could be in the job for 15 years with bad habits, and you could have a day one, student paramedic who's learning well and quite a sponge and taking things in that may have better situation awareness. So there, even though we do talk about something you can't buy with experience, if you do get exposed to scenes more often and you get to feel what those, you know, scene cues and environmental cues were like, it's going to put you in good stead if nothing happened, you know, adverse. However, we do teach process and techniques and assessments and other things like that. And the things that we sort of highlight very early on, and we even teach at university here as well, is little principles. And even we've taught it to ED doctors, and they said this was the one thing that they really took from that is just your distancing, like how close are you standing, to someone when you don't know them or when it seems to be uncertain or volatile. And like Simon alluded to before, it is a very fluid thing, a scene assessment, or a very fluid thing is situation awareness. So it might be yourself and your ambulance partner in a room and you're dealing with a single patient and you've had a good rapport and you've sort of assessed the room, and then you are going, okay, I'm deeming this safe at this point in time, and you start doing your assessment and your treatment. But then someone else enters the room, someone returns home. So now you go back to that scene assessment, you go back to that situation, and you have to tick through those things. So you talk about, how am I positioned in the room with regards to the exits? How am I positioned with now the two people in this room, with me and my partner? What is the positioning, the distancing, and what am I looking at with those red flag cues, whether that's body language or facial expressions or voice tone or even physical attributes of what body language they might be broadcasting, like clenching their fists or biting their jaw or screwing up their face. And we teach all these things as well in the course. So if you get that in university and then early on in your career, it hopefully can reinforce some of that muscle memory and some of those ideas and concepts that then you might even have as, you know, first year paramedic, as opposed to a 15-year-old veteran that hasn't done the training, that may not know what they do or don't know. And that other famous saying is, you don't know what you don't know. But in saying that, if we could keep everyone safe and not get anyone hurt, if we put you out there for 15 years, you would learn a lot off the job just by going to the job, but maybe some things the hard way. And I guess that's why we started this company, is we don't want people to learn the hard way, because the hard way could sometimes be so traumatizing and so devastating. That's not the way to learn, but you will learn from experience, good or bad experience. You'll definitely learn. We just hope we can teach it in the classroom and let them start doing that assessment, sort of those skill sets as they go to every job.
They're fantastic points. And I think my question from that then would be, we train everything, right? Like, we train how to put in our OPAs over and over again so that becomes fluid. And like you said, Simon, basically, you know, when you're new, that doing that blood pressure just takes up all your cognitive bandwidth. If we're learning, say we're doing a scenario at university or as a graduate, and you're just doing this practice in the training room, and you just generally go, oh, have I got any dangers? Yeah, no, tick that off, fantastic. Should we be now utilizing sort of these techniques of being like, okay, I'm really assessing this scene, I'm assessing where the door is, et cetera, how far away I am, where my partner is, and really like verbalizing these and making this in a really coherent part of D for danger in your scenarios and practicing that commonly?
Yeah, most definitely, Alex. In our longer courses, so we run courses from any length from an hour up to 2 days, which is the gold standard. In those two-day courses, we facilitate a lot of high-fidelity simulations, which involve medical skills. So the students might be working through a cardiac arrest, and then there's an element of occupational violence that may occur during that. And because we need to combine the two, it's no good having a clinical scenario without any element of occupational violence or the other way around. Because students need to get used to that this is the environment they're going to work in. So I think that form of training is very important, and it also consolidates all the learning that's been done prior. So a good example, I spent many years educating and training and lecturing at one of the local universities. And I always noted, and even coming up through the ambulance service, that we do that D for danger check. You knock on the door, you walk in. Is everything safe? Yes, D for danger is done. I don't have to think about it anymore. But we know that's not true. We know it's a fluid process. We need to be constantly risk assessing. So one of the scenarios we run, not to give anything away, but involves a heroin overdose, where there's a needle, a syringe of heroin sitting on one of the bystander's laps. Now, if you take that from a basic ambulance point of view or a university point of view, you grab that syringe, you put it in the nearest sharps container, and your D is contained. But in the real world, if you grab someone's needle or syringe of heroin, they won't appreciate that very much, because from what I understand, heroin's pretty expensive. And they're not going to like that. And so they will only further escalate the situation. So in that scenario, we expect that the students or the participants to verbally de-escalate that person. So that syringe you have there, I appreciate it's your property, but it's just worrying me a little bit. Do you mind just putting it behind you and out of the way so we can assess your friend? Those kind of things. It gives it that realism to what they'll actually meet when they get out there in the real world. So I think high fidelity training is so, so, so important in both clinical and occupational violence.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what you're saying, should we be doing it? Yes, is definitely the answer. However, I guess, and not to blow our trumpet. I guess we are becoming quite subject matter experts on this, is we do this within our training. And obviously we are involved with a lot of ambulance service and we'd love to be involved with all of them. And it may be that's the component where we put it in, because there is also saturation. You've got new paramedics learning the clinical skills. But like you said, Alex, is we drill everything, and D is first. We learn the R very well. We learn the A, B, C, D really well. But if you don't get past D, then does it need to be implemented? And yes is the answer. But probably what we like, and what me and Simon probably do find funny, is those, the old school, if you didn't think it was a safety scenario, it's a clinical scenario, it's just, is it dangerous? Not good. But then what we have found, once we do our courses and we do do scenarios, and they do present just to be clinical to start with, we watch how thorough the guys are by saying, hang on, how many people are there? And they're carrying the kit in front of them and they're looking at the door and they're doing everything perfect because they think we're assessing them already, and we are. But it's funny how when it's the forefront of your mind, that everyone does it really well. And then obviously the clinical or the scenes or environmental cues roll out and they start getting into the environment. And then we try throw a few sort of furfies into them where they get attacked from the side a bit, or, you know, get caught off guard or left field. And we see how they do operate under a little bit of duress or a bit of probably uncertainty. And it's really good to see, because it's common practice where it's not predictable out there. And it's really good to have it. And sometimes the opposite happens, where they're expecting everything to be dangerous, like people jump out the cupboards and drop from the trees. And sometimes you just leave it and you don't put anything in dangerous, but they're always thinking about, where did I sit down? Where's my back? Where's my partner? Where's my radio? And it's really good. And they're waiting for this scene to escalate, and it never does. And they carry on the scenario and we can go, you're done. And it's quite good, but they are constantly thinking about it because they are doing our course. But we want people to be like that every day. So whether ambulance service can do that, obviously we could be involved with helping them, you know, set up how they do that. But we definitely do that in our courses, which is probably the best place to do it, because it's teaching them the right habits, you know, well and early on.
Steve raised a couple of amazing points there. The two things from that new paramedics and all paramedics need to recognise, I believe, is that the potential for violence and aggression it rests in everybody. All the three of us, every patient we see, everyone on the street. And it may not be because we're violent or aggressive by nature, but it could be a medical episode. So we're postictal after a seizure. We're hypoxic. We've had some head trauma. Our blood sugar is low. So there's many, many reasons that any individual can become violent or aggressive. So we need to recognize that potential for every patient and every bystander we see. Now, that doesn't mean being overzealous, paranoid, back to the wall, never approaching anybody. But what it does mean is just keeping that awareness that, hey, this could turn at any point. So I need to be aware. And the second point to that is that consistency is the key. So if paramedics are consistently doing the right things in accordance with their safety, then those occasional jobs which does escalate to violence, they don't have to think about what to do or what should have been done, because it's already been done. So we use the example often parking a car. So me personally, wherever I go, I'll reverse park into that car park, because there's a saying that says it's never an emergency when you're arriving, but maybe when you leave. So if whatever happened and I need to leave quickly in an emergency, maybe being chased or trying to get to somewhere, I know I can just drive straight out of that car park. I don't have to move my car around, reversing and then going forwards. And that's just an example of consistently doing the right thing. So if you are consistently putting yourself in the same position in relation to the patient, the door, every single job you do, when it all goes bad, you don't have to think about where you are, because you're in the right position already. And I think those two things can't be underestimated, consistency and that potential. It's so, so important.
Yeah, they are good. Sorry, Alex, it's... that consistency really is good. And Simon talks about the car, and we do stuff where we talk about door appreciation, and it's how you approach a door, like literally a physical door to any venue. And you think if you've got the information via your pager or your data terminal or the phone call, however, you receive information and it says 70-year-old, you know, Beryl has chest pain. Probably some people aren't thinking, you know, we have to be in a good way judgmental of information for our safety, not judgmental of the people or the environment or their choices. But there are demographics or scenes or certain types and age of people that are going to have fit into the high percentage of people that have been the assailants of the aggressors when it comes to assault. But you might get information that might go, okay, I'm going to see this already as a red flag, but you don't start thinking, oh, I'm going to be safe on this scene and I'll use my, you know, personal safety training on this scene. But if you have 79-year-old Beryl, oh, I'm safe. So if you approach that door the same way and 999 times it's fine, then that one time you were doing the right things, like Simon was saying, it really creates great habit and muscle memory. And habit does take time and experience to develop, but develop it in the benign, safe times. So then we talk about that at martial arts, where sometimes you learn a defense against something, whether it might be a punch. And my trainer said years ago, well, if you're in a dark alley, you're not normally oftenly attacked in a fluorescent lit room in your training gear with, you know, no shoes on. You're out in the dark alley and there's silhouettes, there's lights in your eyes or behind you, and you can't see if that is a punch or a weapon wielded hand. So he said, try learn a defense that will be the same for both, because you can't go, oh, I'm going to use my knife defense today, I'm going to use my screwdriver defense, I'm going to use my fist defense. You don't have time to think about that, but consistency creates that safety of, I was doing it the same no matter what it was, and that's a safe, you know, defense to do. The same as my scene assessment, I was doing it consistently for the last 3 years when nothing's happened. Now today something happened, I'm still in the right position, I'm still in the right car park, I'm still in the right place in the room.
Those are fantastic points, and please don't apologize. I love any sort of information you want to add whenever. So
no, I thought you were about to talk, and
Good. You guys bring up fantastic points, and I love the consistency part of it, because realistically, you do that for any other part of your training. Why not this? So I really love that. And so this has all pretty much happened, like all these things that we've talked about. This is happening before you're walking in the door, just as you're about to walk into that door. Now, I'd love to get, because obviously de-escalation is something that's really, really important, and particularly when you think about those scenes that are a bit chaotic and you've got someone who's not thinking rationally or are behaving rationally, and you really do need to de-escalate them down to, something that is a bit more calmer, so that you're able to then work with that person and you're safe, they're safe, and you can do what you need to do as a paramedic. But obviously to get to that point, as you guys mentioned, you need to actually understand what escalation is and how the person gets from, as we would be now, up to someone who could be an aggressor or who is violent. So what is that, you know, ladder, I guess, of or steps of escalation in someone, and what are the cues or red flags?
So most people follow a predictable trajectory when it comes to escalation. So there's six steps. So it starts at irritation, frustration, defensiveness, anger, aggression, and then physical violence. And in the lower couple, so irritation and frustration, if you don't know that person, you probably won't even recognize the signs. They should be able to hide them and control them quite well, which means you shouldn't really have to de-escalate them. It's not till you get about to level three when they become a bit defensive, and then level four where they're a bit angry at the situation, that you actually need to use your de-escalation skills. Because at this point, the people have a lot less trouble hiding those emotions, and they're starting to have trouble controlling them, which is where they actually require your verbal de-escalation. But then you get into the danger ones. So the difference between anger and aggression, so which is four and five, is that level four is they're angry with the world and the situation around them, not you personally. But when you hit level five, they actually become angry at you personally. And that's when it becomes really dangerous, because it's easy to slip to level six, which is physical violence. So before we attempt to de-escalate someone, we need to have an idea where on that escalation trajectory they sit. Because if they're up around four, five, six, their bandwidth is so full that they've lost auditory, they've lost cognitive processing ability. And it doesn't matter how good we are at verbalizing, at de-escalating, or using those non-verbal cues and those verbal cues, it won't work on them, because they're not in that place of mind where they can actually accept that, process it, and act on it. So they're the kind of situations where we need to retreat. So we need to evacuate to a safe space, hit our duress buttons, call for police backup. And they are the ones that should be dealing with that level of escalation. So where we can really shine as paramedics is the 2, 3, 4s around there. And what we find, if you don't have good de-escalation skills, we can actually inflame the situation and we can escalate them up higher. So it's where those de-escalation skills become so apparent, so important. And there's so much to that. It's a massive, massive topic. And we look at communication, which is probably the biggest part of it, which is effective communication. We talk a lot about verbal and non-verbal communication, because non-verbal communication is actually the number one way we transmit information in a communication. So it's about 55% of what we say is given through nonverbal communication, which means we need to be really aware of what we are presenting to that person. So we need to have the right body language, open,
slightly side on, hands in view, and nodding along with them, affirming what they've said, paraphrasing back to them, acknowledging their feelings. Those kind of things are so important just through nonverbal communication. But we need to be aware that that person is also giving us nonverbal communication cues as well. So they're the red flag indicators we spoke about. So if they're pacing back and forwards, they're rocking left and right, they're a split stance, which is one foot in front of the other, maybe they've dropped a shoulder back, they're wringing their hands out, they're rubbing their forehead, all these things are cues that they're about to escalate to physical violence. We need to get good at recognizing them. And then the second way we communicate, it's still not the words that we use, the most important way, it's the modulation, it's our tone, where we put pauses, all those kind of things. In fact, the words that we say are only 7% of the amount of communication we do. It's really quite a small amount. So we need to get good at everything else. And then that 7% is the tip of the iceberg. And when it comes to that 7%, there's things we can be doing. We need to get good at recognizing when a closed question is important. So a closed question is obviously when we're looking for a yes-no answer, as opposed to an open-ended question, which are great for gathering history, such as, hi there, how can I help you today? Or what did you call an ambulance for today? They're great at inciting broad answers, but some opportunities, some situations call for closed questioning. So we need to know the difference. We need to get really good at listening to people, and not just having them talk and us nodding along, but thinking about what we're going to do for lunch that day, or even what clinical pathway we're going to head down. We need to really listen and try to understand what that person is going through. Because the greatest de-escalation tip of all, I believe, is that we can align ourselves with that patient and help them to solve the problem that they have. Because for them, this is the worst day of their life. They've called the ambulance because they're in a crisis that they can't solve. They need us to help them solve that. And if we can be seen to be working towards a mutual resolution with them, that rapport building is so important. So we need to really make sure we have their best interests at heart. And when we show that through that verbal and nonverbal communication, de-escalation becomes a whole lot easier.
Yeah, Simon raises a great point, and there raised lots of great points. Another thing I'll expand on, which we see a lot, and this is not victim blaming or definitely not ambo bashing in any way, because Simon and myself are ones and probably guilty of these, hopefully in the past, not so much now, is a lot of the statistics we look at, we've been involved with the violence and aggression steering committees of our own service and other companies. And lots of the assaults and aggressive sort of behaviours and encounters we've seen and heard about that have been documented, we could probably say, fair to say, and not mentioning industries or places or names, probably could have been avoided, which is a good thing, which means we can, if it was all unavoidable, it'd be a grim, scary world out there. But it probably is some of the things that we are doing as probably paramedics and people communicating is, are we escalating the situation as well? So if something is escalating, it's quite simple if you want to really simplify things down. And like Simon said, if we can work out where they are on that trajectory, we can work out, are my de-escalation skills going to work or are they not? And if they are, I'm going to give this a good go at showing this person true understanding and empathy and try bring resolution to this. But if I know where they're at and it's not going to work, then that's a simple clear cut. My safety comes first, so we retreat, and that doesn't need self-defense or anything. But sometimes in that process is, are we engaging in power struggles? Are we broadcasting judgment? Are we rolling our eyes, folding our arms, or talking to a partner like snidely? And that people wonder why things escalate. So sometimes there's a lot we can have control of ourselves, because we talk about our own behaviours and controlling aggression. Sometimes there's this sort of re-entrant circuit that you can't short circuit, where we say our attitudes lead to our behaviour. Our behaviour affects other people's attitudes. Their attitudes leads to their behaviour. So where in that point has the problem happened? Was it we see this bad behaviour or this bad attitude to a patient, we walk in, they're being aggressive, they're being violent, they're being using profanities, and we think, oh, they've got the problem. But then did we really pay attention to how did I walk in the room? How did I talk to that person? Did I show judgment? We might have gone back a step. It might have been our attitude and our behavior that influenced their attitude and their behavior. But it doesn't matter whether we know or are right or wrong or correct or incorrect. The point is we can only control our own attitude and behavior. That's the only thing we're in control of. If we do that well and have empathy and have humility, it's not being a doormat. It's actually going, well, I want to give this person the benefit of the doubt. I want to give them my best personality and the best foot forward, like we talk about intubation, is, you know, make your first attempt your best attempt, make your first rapport build your best attempt. Don't try backpedal after and, you know, dig yourself out of trouble because you've, you know, 13th hour of your night shift and you're a bit grumpy. It's hard, fatigue, and we talk about all the things that factor into assaults, but all these things, if we can give them our best ambulance, you know, relationship, then we're probably going to put ourselves in good stead anyway. So prevention really is better than cure with so many things. But yeah, we need to be able to control what we can control, because there's a lot of things that are out of our control, but we need to refine, tune and hone the bits that we can control. And that comes down to everything, as in the consistency we talked about, is always have your radio on, always park the car the same, but always give them benefit of the doubt, is don't have judgment, don't have power struggles. And granted, there's some people that are just wanting to manipulate and take advantage, then, you know, leave. Then don't worry about a power struggle. I'd rather go home at night having, you know, being called a name, as opposed to think I'm right and I've got the right to judge this person and then go home with a broken nose. That's not what we want to do.
Absolutely. You guys bring up fantastic points, and in particular that in terms of giving patients your best foot forward, basically, and if you're presenting yourself as best as you can, that realistically at the end of the day, that's all coming down to a patient-centered care sort of focus anyway.
Yeah.
And as you know, everyone knows, rapport is so difficult to build, and then it's so easy to lose, and it can happen in such a quick amount of time, and particularly if someone who is in such a heightened state is unable to think rationally, and then, you know, you've lost it really quickly if you said something wrong or done something that may continue to escalate them further on that trajectory. Mm. There's some really fantastic points in there. And I love how – that's incredible how only 7% of your verbal communication has got any sort of impact in these situations. That's pretty incredible. So how do we make that 7% actually count?
Yeah, it's a good question. When we're talking to these people in this heightened state, we need to recognize that they've lost – that thought processing ability, because their heart rate is probably close to the maximum heart rate at that time. We talk about, so there's a lot, I have to understand the physiology behind this, but if you have your resting heart rate, then you have your maximum heart rate, and it only takes a slight increase about 65% of your maximum heart rate that you start to lose some fine motor skills. And then about 80%, you start to lose gross motor skills. And then when you hit about 100% or your maximum heart rate, which is roughly calculated at 220 less your age, you start to lose that cognitive processing ability. So when we have that sympathetic stimulation or that adrenal dump, we quickly get to that heart rate, we start to lose thought processing ability, which means we're not as effective in our de-escalation as we would have been in the lower heart rates. But the person who is assaulting us or who's being aggressive towards us, they have that same sympathetic stimulation, that same adrenal dump. They're going through the same things that we are. So they've got that high heart rate, low thought processing ability. So anything we say to them needs to be really specific. It needs to be really clear. We need to give one idea per sentence with long pauses in between so they can have some thought processing time. And we need to repeat the same things over and over again, which would often seem absurd in a normal everyday conversation. But to this person in that heightened state, it's what we need to do. So we need to repeat often our names. We need to repeat that we're here from the ambulance, that we're here to help. And any directions we give, they need to be very clear, very concise, and using minimal words, because that in that person's heightened state is all they're able to process.
That's really interesting. And such an important point. Like I've never known that in terms of repeating what you say, and it makes so much sense now when you talk about it. And I love the culmination between your own physiological response to stress and then being able to relate that to the patients. I think that one puts yourself in the patient's shoes as well to understand what they may be going through. So that's really interesting. So I guess too, like we hear a lot, and I don't know if you've guys heard it, you've been in the job for a very long time, but I've heard it a lot in my very short time. You know, you hear a lot of people just say, oh, I'm just going to droperidol them, or, you know, chemically restraint them, that person. And I feel like there's this massive now jump between kind of avoiding de-escalation techniques and just going straight to the chemical restraint and sort of being like, that's not my problem anymore. Like, I'm just going to hit straight to the top point of the ladder in terms of management of this sort of acute behavioral disturbances. So What do you guys sort of consider about that and sort of try and challenge that cult? I wouldn't say cultural norm, but like that sort of mindset.
Yeah, there's a couple of issues with that. The first one is that restraint is a potentially psychologically damaging thing that we do to people, whether that's chemical or physical, mechanical restraint. It has the potential to be really quite psychologically damaging. So it should never be our first option unless we are in danger. So if we or others are in danger from that person needs to be restrained, like I say, via chemical or mechanical, then we need to do that. But in most cases, de-escalation can often avoid that whole situation. I share a very good story in some of my courses about this. And just to share it quickly with you, it was a young lad who was having a really rough time as a result of a medical condition he had. But because of that medical condition he had suffered from seizures, which they're having trouble controlling. And then that meant that this poor guy had lost his driver's license. And because he lost his driver's license, he then lost his job. And during this whole period, he also lost his relationship as well. So he had so much going on in his life to the point that he became really aggressive, that police were called to his house. But what the police did was rightly so, is they took a hold of him straight away because they needed to restrain him for his safety and others' safety. But no one actually gave him the chance to talk. Now, it would have been easy for me because I was the first one on scene there by myself. I could have walked up with a syringe full of midazolam or droperidol or ketamine or something and chemically sedated this fellow. But I deemed it safe enough while he was under police control to actually say to him, mate, what's going on? And then I gave that large pause that we spoke about so he could process this because he was in a very heightened state, as you can imagine. But then he started to talk and he told me this whole story. And he must have seen the look on my face because it was something like, whoa, that's terrible. You're having the worst day. But he understood that I had really tried to understand what he was going through. And to that point, no one had given him the opportunity to talk. And it was so powerful, just letting this fellow tell his story and having someone listen to him and try and understand what this poor guy was going through. And he didn't need chemical sedation. He didn't need any further physical restraint from the police. He went to hospital voluntarily and got the help that he needed. But it would have been so easy for that to go differently. And when I look back at that job, he would have been chemically sedated, restrained to the bed, and who knows what psychological trauma that would have caused him. So that's the first issue. The second issue is what we notice in a lot of ambulance services is the assaults that occur, the physical assaults, the biting, the kicking, the spitting, those kind of things, happen when we are trying to restrain someone. So in our ambulance service, we have a net which goes from head to ankles and it restrains people to the bed. And putting that blanket or that net on is when people often get assaulted. When someone is being held down to have the chemical sedation administered to them is often when an assault occurs. So it's not a simple thing as to say, I'll just sedate this person. It actually comes with some danger to ourselves as well. So it's a decision we really want to think long and hard about.
Yeah, but Alex, I think you've alluded to something too, which is just anecdotally I've observed, so I don't know this, but there is a cultural shift, and I think it's probably been a misunderstanding that chemical restraint is that the word it's restraint has been probably mistaken for chemical de-escalation. And I think people are using it for de-escalation, and we've got so many other skills we can use to de-escalate someone if they're escalating. Obviously, there is a point where it's probably not going to be safe to de-escalate, which we've spoken about when we talk about. So everything sort of does marry up, all the training crosses over. But if we think we cannot de-escalate this for their safety or ours, then we have to take some other options. I think there's been a bit of a goalpost shift or a cultural shift or an understanding shift where we're jumping in now with restraint options to de-escalate someone. And it shouldn't be that, it should be to restrain them. And that restraint, even the word sounds a bit aggressive, intimidating, but truly is for their safety and ours, for both. So that's where I don't like where some things have come from in the health department in general, is we're probably mistaking some of the use of our skills and practices for the wrong option sometimes, I probably should say. And then that's probably then it has a ripple effect, because you think, say, this person has an interaction now with the ambulance service and they were going through something that was quite, you know, traumatizing to them or quite an emergency and a crisis for them, and they ring and they choose to ring for help or someone on their behalf rings, and then the first thing that happens is they get held down, jabbed and whatever. They're not going to feel really probably trusting of the ambulance service or the hospital or the health system. So the next time they have a crisis, they're probably going to be even more, probably less help they probably receive. They're going to be probably more volatile because they're further down that path without getting help. Or the next person that does come, they know what's going to happen. So they're probably going to be even a bit more, agitated and aggressive because they think they know what's coming. They weren't given probably the chance. And that's not to say don't have good situation awareness, which we teach is the other side of things, is you've got to get good at learning through this and you won't always get it right. And we're human beings, when I said we might be tired, we might be fatigued, but the trouble is try to think of what options we want to use first that are probably least invasive if we can. And that's it's a tricky act to know when and when not to do something. Like anything, they say sometimes doing a surgical airway clinically, the actual psychomotor skill is quite easy, but the hard part of experience is when knowing to do it or when knowing not to do it. Same as this sort of stuff. It's easy to teach restraint, the dosage. It's easy to teach the net. It's easy to teach verbal de-escalation skills, but the nuances and the tricky part of it is knowing, well, when is this going to be effective? When is this going to help me and my safety? When is it going to be unsafe to try this and realize, oh, I should have sedated it earlier. Now I've been assaulted. So it is tricky, but I do stand by thinking we are probably using it more as de-escalation, not restraint in certain instances.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up a really good point there in terms of when you're thinking about it, like that person may have had a really poor experience prior to you. And so I think you're presented with an opportunity to be able to impact that person's future experiences or, I guess, mindset towards future healthcare professionals, whether that be your care and with you in the ambulance right then and there, might set them up very well or poorly for the ED when they get in there, depending on how well you treat them and how much respect you give that person. And so obviously if they've gone through this heightened crisis where you've treated them, you know, really well, de-escalated, have avoided chemical restraint because it's safe to do so in the setting that is in front of you, then maybe next time they're not going to be as hesitant to call an ambulance, or it's not going to get as heightened potentially. Like there's all these different sort of scenarios that may play out. But I really love that. Now, before we wrap up, because I mean, I'm loving this conversation. You guys are absolutely incredible to talk to. And obviously we can't go through physical techniques today because we can't really do that. But let's say this, we've done everything we can. There has unfortunately been a situation of occupational violence. How do we go through debriefing this? And then what's the process from there? Just real quickly.
Yeah. So debriefing is an interesting one. So we actually have a section on after the event in our teaching, because there's certain things we need to do. So one of the things is debrief, but a debrief can never be forced onto someone. They have to be ready to accept it and be involved in it. So debrief should certainly be offered at the completion of the incident. But if it's not accepted, it doesn't mean it should never be offered again. And we need to, when we do debriefing, not look to victim blame, but just have a look at the incidents as a whole and work out what things went well and what things didn't and what things could be done for next time. So it's a learning process to stop this happening to us in the future. So debriefing is hugely important. So are things such as documenting the event, because if this was to progress through charges with police and then go through the court system, by the time it actually gets to court, it's probably 2 years down the track. And what you will remember from 2 years later is very different to probably what happened to you right then. So you need to be documenting things as soon as you feel up to it. Then we need to be accessing some psychological support. So most ambulance services around the world have some employee assistance programs, such as a peer support, where maybe some paramedics are trained in some counseling techniques. And they can have that debrief with you and talk to you about the things. But there needs to be that offer of psychological support. Most services also nowadays employ psychologists or psychiatrists as well for that further level of psychological care. And I know from our service and from others as well that offer of support is there, but many people don't take it up because they feel almost ashamed, that I believe, or it's a hit to their ego if they have to seek psychological support. But I say that every single paramedic at some point will need to talk to a psychologist in their career. In fact, the recommendation from the literature these days is that we do it preemptively. Instead of reactively after an event, we should all be talking to psychologists on a regular basis, like monthly, and just like you would take your car to have its annual service. We don't wait for the problem to happen. We put this prehabilitation in place to avoid these issues when they do occur. Because the other side of it is that post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, after an incident of violence or aggression, you're going to have symptoms of post-traumatic stress. That's completely normal. If you're not having those, that's probably more abnormal. But if those symptoms continue, you know, weeks and months into the future and they start to affect your life as a whole, that is a sign that you truly need psychological support, because that could well be post-traumatic stress. And we know many ambulance officers, paramedics around the world do suffer from it, because it used to be kind of, you didn't talk about it. Yeah, that was the culture. It was all part of the job. You kept it to yourself. You push it down, you bottled it up. But we know that's not healthy. We need to be talking about these things. And sharing that experience might help someone else avoid being assaulted in the future as well, because they can learn from your unfortunate experience. So as a company, we offer that service where any participant that we work with, we give our details, both Steve and myself and another two directors, phone numbers and email addresses. And if people who are assaulted or in an incidence of violence in their career want to talk to someone about it external to their organization, they can reach out to us and we can debrief with them as well. So, because all those things are so, so important to your psychological recovery and avoidance of any future incidents.
Yeah, Alex, I mean, just to add to Simon, everything he said there is spot on and correct, and probably the majority and definitely the priority is looking after the person and their psychological well-being and avoiding, hopefully, an extensive PTSD scenario, anything like that. But even I can speak personally as well, is once someone seems to be quite healthy and through the acute trauma, and whether it's physical injury and had, you know, loved ones support them, go to hospital if they've been hurt and injured, and then, you know, looked after their minds as well, is I think this applies to any area of life, to be honest, and it's probably taken me 44 years to really be good at it, is we have an ego, and we all do, and it's healthy if it's in a healthy situation. But I think majority of our problems probably come from ego, and probably majority of not healing and moving on or being teachable is probably from our ego. So say you have, you know, an argument with your partner, is if you're honest and put ego aside and be humble, then I think that's where you will become very teachable, and that's where you have growth. So when you said, what can we do after? So if we are the person that's been involved, is once we want to address a problem, like Simon said, we've got to want to debrief, we've got to want to learn and be teachable. If we can remain teachable and humble, is if you put our ego aside, then you will learn. So sometimes if you have a true, honest look at the situation, what I think is good to do is actually say, you know, put it on that person, saying, you know, what do you think, you know, went wrong? And it might be just, it was completely unpredictable, completely irrational, and it went off, and it may be true. But if we all look at things, we might say, oh yeah, I probably was quite close, or I probably didn't think about this, or yeah, I probably did shoot my mouth off, or it might not be. It sounds like we're always making mistakes, but if we look at it really with an ego aside, we will find the solutions probably yourself, and that's where we can guide and coach and run people through things, especially from the scene safety point of view, or self-defense, or de-escalation, or scene appreciation sort of side. I think we can look at things when they give the scenario and say, well, have you thought about this, or do you remember this training? They go, oh yeah, good point, the safe distance is 3 meters. I was, you know, within arm's reach after this happened, and I probably didn't think about that soon enough. And the best lessons we learn are when we make mistakes. However, we don't want people to be injured to learn lessons, but sometimes it will. And I got assaulted myself at an ambulance function Christmas show, and it's really natural afterwards. It really hurts your ego, and that's even hopefully not from an egotistical person, just in general. And you go through this self-reflection stage of thinking, you know, the injustice of it and why it happened. And if you're being really honest, you put that aside, you're going, wow, I'm pretty lucky. That could have been worse. I don't want that to happen again. I don't want that to happen to my workmates or my family members. How can I learn from this to educate my son, my peers, my loved ones, myself, to not happen this again? And that's where you need to get to, that point of humility and teachability. And sometimes that can take a while.
Thank you for sharing that. That's absolutely fantastic from both of you. And it's such an important part. And hopefully, like, talking to people like yourselves who have been in the job for a very long time, you guys have this, you know, incredible knowledge that you're able to share with the up and coming, you know, professionals. And I think, you know, that's a really fantastic way to, you know, build this sort of conversation around topics like this, because the more people we talk to have been in the job for 15, 20, 30 plus years, who say they go and, you know, seek mental health support, etc., is one of the best ways in which you're able to role model then for people who are coming through, who are new And I think that's a really great way to talk about it. And particularly, as you said, talking about your mistakes and what can be done and learnt from there. So I really love that. Now, thank you guys so much for jumping on today. I think this has been a really amazing conversation. It's, you know, it's been really, really awesome. I've learned so much, and I can't wait to take on board all of these when I'm working as a paramedic in a couple of weeks. So thank you so much. Where can all of our listeners find more about you guys and Guardian Personal Safety Training?
We have a website, which is www.guardianpst, as in personal safety training.com.au. And whilst we work with a lot of ambulance services around Australia, there are some we don't work with, but it doesn't mean we can't help those students or those paramedics, because we offer fully online training as well. So we have a $39 course, which is completely online. It's full of everything we spoke about, plus much, much more, as well as access to all our video library, which is all the self-defense techniques. And that's available to anyone around the world. So there are good resources out there. That's just our company, like I said. But there are good resources out there, because like we said at the start of this, is that the number one, the best way to avoid this is to educate yourself and attend those training courses, do that online learning, and we can certainly minimize the risk of us as individuals being a victim of occupational violence.
Yeah, and watch your space. There's a free ebook coming up soon. So keep an eye on the website, because we're just getting all those links sort of up. If you register and give emails and subscribe, we got a free ebook, and there's obviously we're on Instagram and Facebook. So yeah, search Guardian Personal Safety Training. It will come up with websites and Instagram and find information there. And it has our contact details. If you want any more, definitely contact us. And if you want to know any more for, I think you were just saying, Alex, you know, you didn't get to do this at uni. If you want to even contact us on behalf of your employer or union, I think this would be a good thing to implement is, yeah, contact us and we can start touching base with your employers and talk about all the options we've got, because we are, not to be such a sales plug, but we are quite affordable, but I hope we are sort of broadcasting. We are passionate about paramedics because it's our roots. And if we can help keep you guys safe, and whether it's through yourself individually or your workplace, then we'd love to get in contact with your employers as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'll put all of your links and everything into the show notes so everyone can just quite literally click right now when they're listening to this. And I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. This is fantastic.
No, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.